This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we take a trip into a bunker under the Colorado Plains, the master control center for worldwide GPS. But first, with the spread of the Zika virus, there is no shortage of suggestions about how to contain the mosquitoes that carry it. And now comes news that a certain bacterium might serve as a potent weapon. Here to explain what's going on and share other short topics in science is Ariel Duham-Ross. She's a science reporter for The Verge. She joins us in our CUNY studios in New York. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about what is this bacterium?
So the bacterium is called Wolbachia. It's a bacterium that is found in the blood of mosquitoes, but actually doesn't naturally infect mosquitoes. It tends to infect flies. But researchers found in 2009 that if they injected these bacterium Wolbachia in mosquitoes, it actually drastically lowered the amount of infection that dengue virus actually. Mm-hmm. So the mosquitoes weren't able to really. It kind of was protective. So being infected with Wolbachia was protective for the mosquitoes against dengue virus, and that means that if you introduce these mosquitoes in an area with dengue, over time, because the Wolbachia is transmitted to offspring, they are able to kind of reduce the amount of dengue virus that is in the environment. So recently, scientists figured that maybe they could try this with Zika virus.
Sort of a similar kind of virus.
Right. If perhaps the Wolbachia would also be protective and also protect the mosquitoes from Zika. And they did this in a very, very short trial. This was published in Cell and covered by Carl Zimmer in the New York Times. But they did find that over a period of 2 weeks, being infected with Wolbachia did seem to protect the mosquitoes. They didn't look at a longer period, and they also found that, you know, if you over time, like, it really, really does seem to work. But they didn't look at whether it actually prevents infection in humans. They didn't actually check to see, you know, if it can be transmitted to offspring and if that mm-hmm. also works. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know right now. But if this works, perhaps it could also work for yellow fever or malaria or any other kind of, you know, those kinds of viruses.
Mosquito-borne stuff.
Right. Yeah. And maybe Wolbachia is this kind of secret weapon that we could use against Zika virus and other types of viruses.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another topic that I know you've written about extensively.
Yes.
And it's one of our favorite sort of subjects on Science Friday.
This is true.
Fecal transplants. Mm-hmm. You actually witnessed a homemade do-it-yourself fecal transplant.
Yes, this is something that nobody should ever do. But I wrote about a biohacker who has a PhD in biophysics. But a biohacker named Josiah Zahner, who tried to perform his own at-home fecal matter transplant. He also tried to change the bacteria on his skin by killing off the bacteria on his own skin using antibiotics, which doesn't really work that well. And then trying to replace it with that of his friends. So he made poop pills.
He had to find someone who wanted to be a donor first, right?
Right. He had to find a donor. He used a friend from college that he hadn't seen in 10 years, and that was after multiple donors turned him down, because this is actually quite dangerous. Mm. What he did was dangerous for two reasons. First is because he took a bunch of antibiotics prior, trying to kill off his own gut microbiome and his own skin bacteria. That if he had pathogens in his body, by disrupting the balance in your gut, you can actually make yourself sick. Mm-hmm. So if he had C. diff, which is a terrible bacteria that can really kind of make you extremely sick, that could have flared up. He could have gotten very sick that way. And then also ingesting poop that hasn't been tested in any way, shape, or form, as, you know, was the case with him, can also transmit so many different types of viruses and pathogens and bacteria. He could have gotten very sick. He didn't.
He swallowed someone else's raw poop.
Yes. He made pills with little gelatin capsules. He ate 8 pills, 10 pills, actually, over the space of like 3 weeks, which is a third of what you're supposed to take when you actually have a fecal matter mm-hmm. transplant done for C. diff, which is the only approved way that you're supposed to do it. And he did this to try and fix his gastrointestinal issues. There's no reason to believe that this actually would have worked, but he says that he feels better. But again, it's there's any number of other reasons why he could feel better, and it's extremely unclear if this is actually the reason why, but I did spend 4 days with a man who was ingesting poop, and I wrote about it.
And the take-home message is don't try this
Try this at home. It's very, very dangerous.
All right. Let's move on to something. Let's move on to these new Earth-like planets that scientists have found.
Yeah, scientists have found three Earth-like planets that are 40 light years away from Earth.
It's like a stone's throw, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, they're so close, but they are relatively close, which is interesting. They circle around a dwarf star, so that's their sun, and they're very close to it. And because they're very close to this very, very small star, they seem to have about the same temperatures that were found on Earth. And that's why researchers think that maybe this is our best possible chance at finding life elsewhere. It's unclear if we could actually do that. Scientists are going to use various technologies to try and measure elements in their atmosphere and actually see if this is possible, see if you could find pools of water, for instance. Hmm. And two of the planets do seem to be actually a little bit too close to their sun to form the kinds of pools of water that could support life. Bacteria, for instance. But the third one does seem to be a pretty good option, and I think astronomers are very, very excited right now at what they might eventually find out.
You know, because 40 light years away means it's anything we sent, radio, TV signals, mm-hmm. anything that we sent out 40 years ago would be there by now.
Right.
They would know we're here if there's any sort of intelligent life on either
right.
planet.
Well, that's the thing is that, you know, with the fact that it's 40 light years away, even if we do find the conditions that could support life, what do we do with that information then? Because getting there will take an extremely long time. So even if we do, what are the next steps after that? I think that's a big question that scientists are going to have to answer.
And in the meantime, they'll be looking to see if there are any signs of anything, you know, hopeful on those planets.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Ariel, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Ariel Duham-Ross is a science reporter for The Verge right here in New York City. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And our story begins, just about a year ago with the Palo Alto startup Theranos was promising patients we might soon be able to run diagnostic blood tests for cholesterol levels or kidney problems using a single drop or two of blood harvested by a nearly painless pinprick to your finger. And even better, Theranos promised you could have this no-hassle blood drawn done at your nearest Walgreens or your Safeway at a fraction of the cost of traditional blood tests. At its high point, the company's value had rocketed to $9 billion. And Silicon Valley uses a term for that. It's called a unicorn. Well, today, Theranos is under federal investigation, and its California lab may be shut down. So what could be so bad about a Silicon Valley startup promising to change the face of patient care? Here to weigh the pros and cons is Dr. Eric Topol, a cardiologist and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute in La Jolla, California. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Hi, Ira. Great to be with you.
You were an early proponent of the work Theranos was doing. What was exciting about their project?
Well, you mentioned it in the intro. That is the good part, which is the idea of having very inexpensive, very tiny quantities of blood. The idea of getting this done direct to consumers to get the results back to them. So it really was democratizing laboratory medicine. And this is a field that hadn't changed in many decades. So it was a fresh perspective, you know, very creative, something that we actually need. Those were all the good parts.
And the fact that it was coming out of Silicon Valley, not your normal bio center.
Yes, that's true. And I actually, back in 2013, I had the test. I actually had over 50 lab tests. And, you know, it was done in minutes. And I was impressed the results were consistent with what I would have expected, having had a recent lab panel. So I had tested it. But I started to see some of the downsides, which was the remarkable secrecy, the lack of any transparency with respect to the technology. And here it is, you know, 3 years later, there still hasn't been a peer-reviewed publication of any of the Theranos data from Theranos, comparing it to the reference laboratory central facilities.
So we don't know if, because there's been no test, we don't know how it compares to more standardized testing.
Exactly. And whether, there have been some publications recently, you know, suggesting what, from Mount Sinai, as well as the CMS data, that, of course, the accuracy was a significant concern. But there hasn't been a large head-to-head study that's been done independently or with by Theranos to finally settle the score.
And why do you think that is? What is the fear here, if there is any?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's long overdue. In the conversations I had with Elizabeth, she was taking the route of going through the FDA rather than peer review. And I think that was a big mistake. I think the medical community needs to be assured that the results obtained with the so-called nanotainer, this tiny amount of blood, mm-hmm. are going to be very accurate. And it's great that they cost less and great that the results can go right back to the person, but they have to be accurate because a lot of key medical decisions are made on the basis of these results.
That was Elizabeth Holmes you were talking about, the CEO.
Yes, yes.
Is there a way out of this morass for them and a lesson for other startups?
Yeah, that's another important issue, is can they survive? You know, they have brought on a real scientific advisory board with leaders in laboratory medicine who say there's something there, although we still don't know what it is. And if they start to publish and they start to get the accuracy issues on track, I guess they will make it. But obviously they've been under siege and very significant issues that have cropped up regarding the CMS review and all these other things mm-hmm. that are questionable whether they'll be able to pull through it.
All right. Well, we'll keep watching and get back to you, Eric. Thanks for taking time to join us again.
Thank you.
Eric Topol is a cardiologist and director of the Scripps Translational Institute in La Jolla, California. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk about our reliance on GPS directions. Whoa, do we not? I mean, everything, GPS is everywhere. Has it sent you down a blind alley? It's actually been involved in the deaths of a few people. And also it's changing our brains, how our brains may be wired, because, you know, we're just taking directions. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Surely you have had this experience. You're cruising down the highway. All of a sudden, your little voice in your GPS tells you that in 1,000 feet, get ready to take that exit. There's just one little problem. The exit, unbeknownst to your GPS, isn't there anymore. It's blocked off for construction. No big deal. You wait for the GPS.
Recalculating. Continue 0.7 miles.
Oh, yeah, okay. No harm, no foul. But my next guest writes about one guy who wasn't so lucky. The construction was on a bridge, and he tragically drove right off it. Other unfortunates have followed the commands of their GPS straight into the sea or into remote areas of the desert where they got stranded and died. The rangers at Death Valley grimly call it death by GPS. But our tale today isn't just about bad directions. If you look closely at our modern world, almost everything is touched in some way by the never-ending signal from these satellites, timekeeping, military operations, transportation, crop harvesting, even financial deals on the electric grid. Pretty important technology, which makes one worry, how vulnerable is GPS to spoofing and attack? Greg Milner is the author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. He's based in Brooklyn and joins us in our New York studios today. We have an excerpt of the book up on our website at sciencefriday.com/pinpoint. And if you have a tale of GPS woe to share, give us a call, 877-724-8255, 845. I'm going to do that again, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. Or tweet us at SciFry. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
What intrigued you about GPS enough to write a book? I mean, it seems like a pretty commonplace technology.
Well, in a way, that's exactly what made me get more interested in it. A few years ago, I just started to notice that it was something all of us seemed to use in some way. It was starting to migrate onto phones. I knew people who drove with, you know, everyone it seemed who drove used it. And so I just started to realize how ubiquitous it was, but how little I knew about who was behind it or what was behind it or even how it worked. Then the more I looked into that, the more I realized that it was kind of like peeling an onion in a way. Yeah. Just there was layer upon layer, and everywhere I looked, there was another way that GPS was being used in the world.
Let's define what GPS is. What is happening with our cell phone or whatever with GPS?
Well, GPS, or the Global Positioning System, it's a radio signal sent by 24 active satellites that are synchronized to within nanoseconds. And the satellites are arrayed in such a way where there's a direct line of sight from just about anywhere in the world to at least four of these satellites.
You need four.
You need at least four to get an accurate reading in three dimensions.
Mm-hmm. And where is this controlled? I know you travel and you write about this in the book. To a secretive bunker under the Colorado Plains, which is like a crucial master control for GPS.
The GPS
kind of spooky.
Yeah, it was. And by the way, just a note to anyone who tries to find this: don't try to get there by using GPS, as I learned the hard way.
Is that right?
Yeah, much to their amusement.
It's wiped itself off. GPS?
Well, it's not so much as wiped itself off. It's way out in the middle of nowhere, so the address kind of confuses most GPS systems a little bit. But yeah, it's a Schriever Air Force Base outside Colorado Springs, Colorado, deep within the base. You have to go down, to be led down these corridors, past doors that, that will alarms will go off if you don't go through them quickly enough. There's signs that will authorize the use of deadly force. When I got there, they told everyone in the room to take anything classified off the screen, and my name was in a big screen, actually in a few places in the room, just to remind everyone that there was an intruder in their midst.
Wow. Sounds like something in the movies that you see.
Yeah.
Did it remind you of that?
Well, yes and no. It did in the ways I described, but in one way that might surprise people is I assumed it would be some sort of NORAD-looking thing with lots of blinking light. It's actually
George G. Scott is sitting at a big panel somewhere.
Now, this sort of world's heartbeat is controlled from this room that looks a lot like a nonprofit office or something, about a couple dozen people in there just on tiers looking at their screens very intently, looking at the way the satellites are behaving.
Now, one of the amazing things that you write about is that the Air Force never wanted a GPS.
Yeah, that's one of the amazing things about the story of GPS is that it was an Air Force program that the Air Force itself tried to kill on several occasions. I mean, it was really kept alive by a few people who were just really, really devoted to making sure that GPS became a reality, but they were often fighting a losing battle. The people in the Air Force just could not understand why they needed this.
And so what saved it then?
Well, a lot of it was that it was saved by Congress a couple times, but gradually throughout the 70s when the program began and through the 80s, there just was a slow buildup as the military began to realize that there actually were lots of implications. And the Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, right, in 1990-91 was really what broke it wide open when the world saw all the things that GPS could do.
Let's talk about this tragic phenomenon, death by GPS. You write about a couple that got stranded deep in the Nevada wilderness.
Yeah, Albert and Rita Chrétien, a Canadian couple that were on their way to Las Vegas for a trade show from their home in British Columbia, and decided on a whim to sort of take a little detour. And they didn't tell anyone that they were doing it, so no one knew where they were. And their GPS directions led them astray deep into some really, really remote backcountry in Nevada where nobody knew where they were, and they were missing for several weeks.
Wow, and they tragically, they died, or both of them?
Well, there's a somewhat of a silver lining to the story. Albert died. What happened was their minivan slid into a ditch, and they were stranded. And he went out to look for help a couple times and couldn't find anything. And then he set out one more time to look for what looked like the nearest town and didn't come back. Rita managed to survive, I think, something like 50-something days in the wilderness. It was an amazing story. Most hardened survivalists would have trouble doing it, but she was finally rescued by some off-road people who came by.
Amazing. And one of the things you investigate in the book is what's going on in our heads as we use GPS.
Well, whenever anyone hears one of these death by GPS stories, I find that's the first thing you ask yourself, like, what was going on in their heads? How could this happen? One way to look at it is by what cognitive scientists and psychologists call the cognitive map. That's our sort of innate, ingrown ability to understand our surroundings and where things are in relation to other things. Now, as anyone who has used GPS to get around, especially in a strange area, knows, you don't need that part of your mind to really do that. You don't need context. You just need to follow those directions.
Right.
And so as a consequence, you don't really have to know whatever's going on around you.
Yeah, because back in the day, which is, 10 years ago,
yeah.
You took out the map, you saw where you were going, and if you got lost, you had something else to look at.
Exactly.
Right? Now you have, hopefully there's a coffee shop or a service station you can go over and ask for directions because you have no idea.
Well, one of the ironies of death by GPS is that in most cases, it's not really death by GPS itself. I mean, as the Air Force will tell anyone who asks, they're responsible for that signal that comes off the satellites and for monitoring it. And they do a very, very good job. The GPS signal is almost always accurate. Sometimes it's hard to pick up in cities and urban areas. But if anything, death by GPS incidents are often about GPS in a way working too well. I mean, the GPS and your system and the map program showing that there's a road here. Now, if you had a paper map, you might notice that road is a tiny little ribbon that goes into nowhere, so you might avoid it. If you had no map, you'd probably drive by it and never notice it at all. So in a way, it's not so much death by GPS, it's death by people using GPS.
Yeah. GPS doesn't kill, people kill.
Yeah, exactly.
Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us. I have a tweet coming in. Reminds me of when Michael Scott drove into the lake.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's something that everyone always thinks about. And that was ripped from today's headlines, as a matter of fact. I mean, that's actually happened. People have driven into oceans, into rivers. And you listen to the EMT people who are the first responders, and they always they can't understand how this possibly happened.
You know what? One thing that is surprising to me, and I was reading your book and researching it, is that when we hear about airplanes going down and crashing, we can't find them.
Yeah.
The airplanes are not being tracked by GPS, are they?
Well, not exactly. I mean, airplanes, small craft use GPS a lot for actual navigation. For large commercial jets, it's mostly used at this point for landing guidance, and it's very important. But yeah, when planes are out there in the middle of nowhere, I mean, one thing that people should understand about any GPS tracker is that it's really two things. It's a GPS receiver, but it's also something like a cell phone or some sort of receiver that's transmitting information. When planes are out there in the middle of nowhere, they're out of communications range. I mean, there's ways they can communicate, I believe, through like certain satellite hookups. But
radar.
Yeah. But well, even radar, I think that they're really out of range, as I understand.
Why don't they fix that? Is there nowhere they could put a cell phone on an airplane, turn it on?
I mean, they could. And my understanding is that the FAA, in particular in the United States, is really integrating GPS really, really strongly into airplanes. But, I mean, the famous incident, Malaysian Airlines?
Yeah.
One thing, though, that people should remember is that for reasons that I think people still don't know, the communication systems were all shut off 10 minutes before, people, I think it went down. So even if even if there had been some sort of thing, it still might not have mattered.
It's easy to imagine, and we're talking about these, the GPS is used for high-tech applications. But one of the most surprising things you write about it being used for is sugar beet farming.
Yeah. Yeah, well, GPS, I mean, precision agriculture is what it's called, and many precision agriculture techniques, probably most of them use some sort of GPS. Sugar beets are a good example. They're a very, very hard crop to grow. They need to be harvested very particularly. If they're not picked exactly right, they'll crumble. So what a precision agriculture system does, for example, for a beet farmer, is it lets that farmer know exactly where the seed was planted by the automatic tractor, and it knows exactly where to put the fertilizer and exactly know where to put water, exactly where to harvest it, down to the millimeter.
Wow.
And the reason why farmers love this so much is that the efficiency savings just add up. I mean, when you know exactly how much water to put and where, especially if you have soil maps that show you where you might need different amounts in different parts of the field, it really adds up. I think there's something like 2.5 million farms just in the U.S. and Canada alone that are now using GPS-based precision agriculture techniques.
And see, here I thought it was just for hoeing or putting your rows, but it's even much more.
Oh, yeah, from small farms to large farms.
Wow. Let's go to the phones to Lakewood, Colorado. Hi, Cindy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I called with a great GPS story that my husband and I experienced one winter. We were cross-country skiing near the town of Marble in Colorado on Schofield Pass. And Schofield Pass is a shelf road that goes between Marble and Crested Butte, and you can barely travel it in the summer because it's such a dangerous four-wheel drive road. And we were cross-country skiing on this when a vehicle, and we were in deep snow, like 4, 5, 6 feet of snow, when a vehicle started to try to plow up this road, and it got stuck immediately. And my husband went over to the driver and he said, "What were you thinking?" And the gentleman said, the GPS told me to go this way. And my husband said, you can't go here in the summer with that vehicle, never mind the winter. You can't. This is an impassable road. And I talked to his wife, and I said, are you guys on your honeymoon? And she said, yes. And so this was the way they started out their honeymoon, was on a Jeep lost by GPS, and they ended up having to go to the general store where Marble's very far away, and they had to call in a tow truck to get them out, and they were there for hours, and it cost them so much money.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but you know what? They'll have a story about their honeymoon for the rest of their lives.
We've had a great story telling others about it. We couldn't believe it.
All right, Sydney, thanks for calling.
Yep.
Have a good weekend. We're talking about honeymoons. We're talking about GPS on Science Writer from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Greg Milner, author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. It's a great book because, we don't have any idea how ubiquitous GPS. We just think it's in our cell phone, right? But it's everywhere.
It really is everywhere.
I mean, do we have enough GPS technology on the ground to give early warning for earthquakes or tsunamis or things like that?
That's one of the developments that's happening right now. I mean, there's whole networks of GPS receivers that have been set up around the world to measure tectonic plates, which, by the way, is another amazing thing about GPS, is that it can measure millimeter-level movements of plates. What people have found is that those networks can also be adapted to early detection of earthquakes by integrating them with traditional seismograph techniques.
Mm-hmm. Did you get into any of the controversy about all the radio waves affecting your brain, or people talk about that at all?
Not really. I mean, because one of the interesting things about the GPS radio signal is that when it reaches us, it barely exists. Another amazing thing about even the simplest GPS receiver in your phone is that it can decode this signal that is hardly differentiated from all the other electronic crackle that envelops the Earth. So it's barely there, and yet we can make sense of it.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of tweets coming in. We asked about earlier in the week people to tweet us about getting lost, and Daniel said, GPS tried very hard to get me to drive directly onto the Minneapolis-St. Paul runway en route to a hotel. Should have trusted my own nav skills over GPS.
Yeah.
Well, when was the last time you ever took a map out to look at it?
A paper map.
A paper map.
That is a really good question. I mean, I could lie. I honestly don't remember. I can't remember the last time I did it.
Do you carry them in your car at all?
Yeah. I don't drive that often living in New York as I do, but even when I have, no, I don't even, never looked at a map in the car.
I did recently. It was really a refreshing experience.
You know,
good throwback to the old days of, hey, you get some sort of spatial. Yeah. Are we losing our spatial abilities?
Well, that's the
theory. To know where we are and to think spatially all around us.
I mean, the person who invented the term cognitive map was a psychologist in the 40s, Edward Tolman. And one of the main parts of his theory was that there's different kinds of cognitive maps. There's broad cognitive maps and there's strip cognitive maps. Mm-hmm. He was talking about rats in a maze and how they can form broad cognitive maps that show them the whole maze in their mind. Essentially, I think what's happening is that we're losing our ability to have broad cognitive maps. Like you said, it was kind of refreshing because when you look down at a map, you had like sort of a bird's eye view of where everything was in relation to everything else. It kind of gives you a feeling of sort of just where everything is in relation to every other thing.
Yeah, and you get an idea of the sense of the world around you.
Yeah.
And you can see that, hey, there are mountains in that distance, mm-hmm. and there's a lake coming up. You can anticipate things like that. It's a more enjoyable experience.
It is in a lot of ways.
And so many people don't trust their GPS for good reasons, as you're pointing out.
Yeah.
I remember when I know they're better now, but when the roadmaps first came out, if you wanted to have fun, you put in London and it told you to drive across the ocean on your map. Can you stay with us? We're gonna take a short break, come back and talk a little bit more with
you.
Greg Milner is the author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. And we have an excerpt of the book up on our website at sciencefriday.com/pinpoint. And if you have a tale of woe, you can share it with us. Send us a tweet or leave a little note there up on our website. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back and talk more about GPS. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about GPS, in case you just joined us, with my guest Greg Milner. He's the author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. And we're talking about the ubiquitousness, if that's the right word. GPS is everywhere. It helps run power plants. Mm-hmm. It helps, you know, all kinds of government functions, mm-hmm. control functions. You know where I'm heading on this question is, of course, now we worry about hacking.
Right.
How hackable is GPS?
Well, GPS as a whole, you know, the entire worldwide system is unlikely to go dark. You either have to somehow destroy the satellites or infiltrate the master control station at Schriever, and that's not going to happen. But it's particularly vulnerable to two kinds of things. Jamming, which is self-explanatory, just making the signal disappear. But something even more dangerous is spoofing of the GPS signal.
What does that mean?
Well, spoofing means introducing a bogus GPS signal that GPS receivers in the vicinity mistake for the real thing. It overwhelms the real one, since the real one is weak already. It's easy, and GPS receivers then obey the directions from the phantom signal.
Huh. That's kind of dangerous if you can figure out how to override a GPS signal.
Exactly, it is. Especially when you take into account that one thing that a lot of people don't know about GPS is that it's actually more important, really, as a source of timing than it is as a source for positioning, because that time code is so accurate on it that it's used to synchronize networks over large geographic distances. So, for example, cellular networks will use the GPS timing to make sure that calls are handed off from tower to tower, and all you have to do is disrupt that by, you know, I think a few microseconds, and it can cause some problems. So if you could spoof a GPS signal that confuses receivers in one region, it can have a cascading effect and affect things over a much larger region.
Do we know if this has happened yet? Been spoofed?
We don't know if there's been small-scale spoofing. Some people suspect there has been. There hasn't been a large-scale spoofing attack yet, but that's probably inevitable. It's coming.
With all the automatic driving things we're thinking about, you know, cars, buses, whatever, automating our homes, is that going to be dependent on GPS? You talk about the need for timing and having all this coordination.
Well, one thing that we're seeing is dependent on GPS. It's already a problem. A potential problem is drones. The person who's really done a lot of the research into spoofing GPS, one of the first demonstrations he did, he's a professor at the University of Texas, is he demonstrated to a bunch of military and government officials that he could spoof a commercial drone from about a mile away and make it think that it was 200 feet higher than it was, so then it dived down to the earth and they could save it just in time. So, you know, with hundreds and thousands of drones in the air, you can see how that could be a problem. Self-driving cars will, as my understanding is that they will use GPS, not exclusively, but for some of their functions. And you can see, again, how that might be a problem.
See if we can get a phone call in before we have to go. Let's go to Chase in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Chase.
Hi. Just want to say before I ask my question, I'm a huge fan of your show.
Well, thank you.
That being said, when we were in Afghanistan, we had like wrist garments. We bought like wrist garments out of our pocket that like hikers and stuff use. But our command group eventually told us we couldn't use those. We had to use the government issued ones because they could hack into the garments and find out where we're coming from and all that good stuff. I just want to know like how likely or even easy is something like that.
Good question, Greg.
Well, I see why they told you. The military signal is, from what I understand, almost unhackable. I mean, unspoofable. You're not. It's much more secure. But it's interesting what he said because, I've heard that surveys of soldiers stationed in Iraq and Afghanistan have shown that their preferred way to get around are iPhones and iPads because the GPS receivers are actually more flexible on those because they take lots of different signals, whereas the military ones only take the military GPS signal, and so that the soldiers actually prefer to use these to get around from one place to another.
Thank you, Chase. Thanks for your call. I guess he's gone. Thank you for your service. Well, we've run out of time. It's a great book, Greg.
Thank you.
It's terrific. The history, you know, I remember when back in the 1980s, I was taken by the U.S. Geological Survey on a tour of the fault line. I went to Hollister, California.
Yeah.
They were waiting for an earthquake to happen. And I was with, I think it's Lynn. I can't think of what his first name was. And we were in his pickup truck. it's got to be like 1983 or something. Yeah. And in between us was this box with old Nixie tubes on them, with, you know, the old numbers. And the numbers were fluctuating wildly. And I said to him, what is that? And he said, watch this. And he zigzagged around the road and the numbers were going crazy. And I said, what's happening? He said, that's coming from a satellite tracking us and giving me the coordinates of where we are. I didn't realize how far back technology went.
Yeah, the real hardcore research started in 1973 or thereabouts. First satellite went up in 78, and by the time you were doing it, there were probably a few satellites. It didn't have worldwide coverage yet, but there are a few satellites in the air.
In your book, you talk about the history of this.
Yeah.
Greg Milner is author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds, and we have an excerpt of the book up at sciencefriday.com/pinpoint. Thank you, Greg, and good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, how about a quiz? Just a fun little test on how accepting you are of robots. Number one, would you trust your life to an autonomous car? Let it navigate you through heavy traffic? You know, self-driving car, think about it. Now, number two, would you trust your life to an autonomous surgeon? And I'm not talking about a robot that helps a surgeon. I mean a robot that can perform sutures and delicate operations all by itself without the help of a human. You okay with that? If so, you might have the opportunity to experience surgery at the robotic hands of a machine sometime soon, because my next guest and his colleagues have developed something they call the Smart Tissue Autonomous Robot, or STAR. They described their invention in the journal Science Translational Medicine. And one of the authors is Dr. Peter Kim, Vice President of Sheikh Zayed Institute for Pediatric Surgical Innovation, Associate Surgeon in Chief at Children's National Medical Center in D.C. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Good afternoon.
So is this right? This robot can operate completely by itself? No surgeon using a joystick or anything like that?
Well, it is programmed by surgeon, but it can accomplish a complex surgical task such as anastomosis, which is putting together two tubular structures, whether it be blood vessel or intestine, autonomously, as in it will adjust itself, follow, and then provide a sort of an optimal functional outcome.
So how do you teach the robot to be a surgeon?
Well, I mean, as a surgeon, I'm a pediatric surgeon, and I do four things when I do an operation. I spend a little bit of time getting to the problem. I spend most of my time getting rid of the problem and putting it together. And this is like an anastomosis, reconstructing. And at the end, I spend a little bit of time closing the wound. So the whole idea is that if you can do the sort of complex, delicate reconstruction part, you could sort of imagine that you can do the entire procedure autonomously. As a surgeon, I use my eyes and my hands and my mind, as in training and experience and so on, to be able to accomplish a task. And if I can program some of my best ability and way in which I follow the tissues and way in which I use my hands and where I make a judgment into the machine, then one would think that you can accomplish this autonomously. The purpose is not to simply have a machine do it by itself, but the purpose really is to make the outcomes better. You know, surgeons have been sewing for hundreds of years, but we really never focused on making the outcomes better. So even when we transitioned from open surgery to keyhole surgery to more recently to robotic assisted surgery, the outcomes have been pretty much the same and complication rates haven't changed. And take an anastomosis as an example. If you have a complication such as a major leak or disruption, your risk of dying from that is 3 to 10 times higher. So if you have a technology, whether it be autonomous or non-autonomous, and let's say it improves your chances of having a successful outcome and minimizes complication, why wouldn't you, as a patient or a loved one, not wanting to have it?
I guess it's sort of like a sewing machine can sew better stitches than you could by hand.
Yes, but it's a smart one because it has best source ideas and knowledge and training into it. And that's at the same time, it adjusts to the changing environment. I mean, that's really the intelligence behind it.
So it gets smarter over time.
But not this one in particular, this particular generation of it, but over time. My idea is that if you can program cumulative experience of all surgeons today and over the history, then any time if you have a smart machine like this that would have that best practice available to you, then just imagine anywhere, any place in the world, if you need a particular procedure done, you'll have a supportive history of surgical kind behind you, and then ensures the better outcome, if you
will. So the robot could then sort of go online and look for the kind of surgery it's doing and learn how to do it.
Well, that is in the future, but in this one, just as a proof of concept, we demonstrated that what couldn't be done before, because like an intestine as a soft tissue is it's different shades of pink, it's mobile, it moves, and it, you know, in the background of other tissue, so it's very difficult for a machine to know. It actually, machine does not know at all. All the tools we have today, including the current robotic surgery, is simply a fancy extension, motorized extension of surgeons' hands and skill set, if you will. So it really doesn't make it any better than your surgeon. Whereas in this case, by programming better practice into it, it helps surgeon and then performs better that way.
So this has been tested against good operating surgeons and found to be better than the
That's
surgeon.
Right. So when we did the test, we compare essentially putting together a pig intestine done by this particular machine and against the sort of very experienced internationally known surgeons using open technique, as in using their hands, and minimally invasive, as in keyhole surgery instruments, and then currently available robotic instruments. And at the end, we measure the quality of anastomosis, how the gaps of stitching, and how often they made mistakes, and then ultimately the functional outcome, as in whether or not it leaks under pressure and so on. Mm-hmm. The machine, the star performed better. Surprisingly.
Let's talk about price, because we always talk, you know, medicine's all about the money.
It is, yeah.
What do you think a price tag of a machine like this is going to come in at?
So when you do a minimally invasive, the keyhole surgery, the capital cost these days would run somewhere between $80,000 to $100,000. If you buy a robot, it's $1.5 to $2 million. The way we envision this is that it will be orders of magnitude sort of a lower. But the real value proposition here is that whenever, if you can minimize complication, one complication where your risk of dying from it is 3 to 10 times higher. I mean, that is really priceless. So that's the value proposition for the society and as well as the healthcare system, in addition to making the capital cost of the machine much lower. Our idea of a robotic surgery is not that whole thing should be done by a robot from beginning to end, which is the current paradigm, and then robot simply repeats what surgeon does. But robot should come in a time and a place where it does its function best, and then put it away, and then the rest of it can be done by human beings.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato talking with Dr. Peter Kim about new autonomous robotic surgery. Give me an example. I hear what you're saying. You're saying we're not trying to replace all surgeons.
No.
We're trying to replace them where the robot would do something better. Give me an example of how where you'd use one.
So you know, the common example would be, we talked about anastomosis, but let's take a hysterectomy, which is relatively commonly performed procedure in this country. I didn't realize until last year that there are 600,000 hysterectomies done in this country. At the end, you still have to close that little hole, and because it's way down in deep in a pelvis, it's the gynecologist, if you will, spend long time trying to put handful of sutures in there, and the leakage rate is fairly significant. Or another example would be if you have to put, let's say, for hernias, and if there's a weakness in your wall, and oftentimes people put up a patch there, and almost very much like a carpenter trying to sort of patch up a little hole. And when you put those little sutures around the patch, it is almost like a painting a sort of ceiling of Sistine Chapel. It's sort of very awkward and so on. And where, you know, when you have an autonomous machine, intelligent machine like this, then it can help you, surgeon, to do that, and when that sort of task is at hand.
Mm-hmm. You tested the machine's ability to stitch two tubular structures together, right? But
that's correct.
Can it do any surgery, or is it more of a one-trick pony for tubular? You know.
It does linear things, and so it is specifically designed to test the sort of anastomosis suturing task. But again, that's just the proof of concept. Whole idea here is that if you can add intelligence to the current surgical tools, and then give a little bit of autonomy, as in provide the best sort of a surgical practice that's programmed into it, mm-hmm. and with the vision technology we have, and this will certainly help to minimize the potential complications and have a better outcome.
Does it need special eyes to work?
It does have special eyes.
How does it see?
Well, so up till now, we've always relied on human eyes, human visual spectrum, and including, you know, current laparoscopic ones. You know, we're focused on more definition and then seeing it brighter and so on. But whereas this one in particular has what we call 3D quantitative imaging. So it informs the machine where things are in three-dimensional space. Then we added a little bit of a near-infrared vision, which is sort of similar to a night vision technology, so that it knows exactly where the targets are. And then it can manipulate the tools in a sub-millimeter accuracy. So that's really the vision that enables the machine to see better. And then our sort of a goal, and we're working on other sort of a vision technology, that will enable the machine and the surgeons to see much better than what human beings would otherwise.
When do you think you get FDA approval for your machine?
It will take a few years. But having said that, when we chose some of the components of this technology, we chose ones that are already in clinical practice. So
Very smart.
So we're not reinventing a wheel. You know, very much like a iPhone, as an example, you know, the mobile phone, because everything that's in there is nothing newly invented, but it's the combination of things that enables it as a mobile platform. Mm-hmm. The same here, as in we modified tools and adapted it. We add some new sensors into it. The vision technology, again, is each individual ones are sort of currently used and approved. And then, obviously, really the smart part is the adding intelligence to the machine.
Well, good luck to you, Dr. Kim.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. Dr. Peter Kim, Vice President of the Sheikh Zayed Institute for Pediatric Surgical Innovation and Associate Surgeon in Chief at Children's National Medical Center in D.C. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Luke Roskin, our video producer. Our digital team is headed up by online managing editor Julie Leibach, Chow Tu, Brandon Echter, Daniel Peter Schmidt, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the production center of our studio partners, the City University of New York. And for you New York listeners, what a fabulous prize. We have a geeky science event coming up, our second annual Science Friday Trivia Night. It's May 18th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Tickets available at sciencefriday.com/trivia. Y'all had such a great time last year. We're doing it again. That's the Bell House in Brooklyn, May 18th. Tickets sciencefriday.com/trivia. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.